From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Islamic Jihad claims responsibility for a suicide bombing, this time in Haifa, as the Israeli government seizes Orient House and raises, then lowers the Israeli flag over it. That's the Palestinian headquarters and a symbol of international diplomacy. We'll talk about the secret behind the sanctions, how the U.S. intentionally destroyed Iraq's water supply, and in the aftermath of Bush's decision to severely restrict stem cell research, we'll look at how literal federal funds means little federal regulation.
No women should be being paid to produce eggs in order to produce embryos in this totally impersonal and commercial way.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are cutting short next month's annual meetings in Washington because of expected protests by thousands of anti-globalization activists. Talks will now be limited to essential business over the weekend of the 29th and the 30th, rather than running till October 4th. City authorities fear up to 40,000 demonstrators will descend on the city for the meetings, which follow massive protests at July's G8 summit of leading industrialized nations in Genoa. But protesters say planned rallies will proceed no matter what the length of the summit. Washington's police are planning to draft in thousands of extra officers from New York and other nearby states for the summit. Meanwhile, because of the shortening of the meeting, protest organizers said it will give them time to focus on other issues as well, protesting President Bush's corporate agenda and D.C. General Hospital, where there are plans to privatize the institution. Six Central American nations have announced their intention to negotiate lower prices for AIDS drugs from major multinational pharmaceutical companies in a bid to permit greater access to life-saving medicines. The decision was adopted at a meeting of health ministers from Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, and Nicaragua. In Latin America and the Caribbean, estimated 1.8 million people live with HIV/AIDS of the 36 million infected throughout the world. One firm, Merck, Sharp & Dohme, has offered to slash the price of two of their products up to 85%, but the Central American health ministers have agreed they should aim for across-the-board discounts from all the companies by dealing with them in bulk. The exorbitant price of the cocktail of drugs that can prolong the lives of HIV and people with AIDS makes them largely inaccessible for the majority of people in the region. More than 2,000 South Korean villagers sued their government today seeking compensation for unbearable noise from U.S. bombing exercises near their village. In the lawsuit filed with a Seoul civil court, the villagers demanded $15,300 each in compensation for decades of suffering from noise from the Kuni bombing range near their village on South Korea's central west coast. The suit followed a court ruling in April that ordered the Seoul government to pay 14 other villagers roughly the same amount. It was the first court ruling holding South Korea responsible for mental damages to villagers because of the U.S. military and its bombing of the area. This news from San Francisco in a deal that could cost Ford Motor Company as much as $1 billion and affect millions of vehicles. The automaker has agreed to settle a lawsuit that alleges its cars and trucks stall. The agreement ends years of litigation in which a California judge said the Detroit automaker was living in an Alice in Wonderland dreamland for denying ignition switches were defective. The proposed settlement, announced late Sunday, comes 4 months after Alameda County Superior Court Judge Michael Balachi ordered as many as 2 million vehicles in California recalled as part of a statewide class action suit in which the judge found that Ford concealed the shabby parts from government inspectors. The Detroit automaker denies the ignition devices are defective and stall, but already has settled hundreds of wrongful death, injury, and other suits in connection to allegations of Ford vehicles stalling. A federal grand jury has charged 15 Greenpeace activists and two foreign journalists arrested in a protest of the Star Wars program last month with felonies in the disruption of the Pentagon's anti-missile defense test at the Vandenberg Air Force Base near Lompoc, California. Their arraignment is scheduled for today in a Los Angeles federal court. The defendants are six Americans, two Germans, two Britons, two Australians, one Indian, one Canadian, and a Swede. They're charged with conspiracy to violate a safety zone. A Spanish videographer with a United States green card and a British photographer, both freelance journalists, face similar charges. The charges, made recently, carry a maximum sentence of more than 11 years in prison and fines totaling more than $500,000, and are among the stiffest ever handed down to nonviolent protesters arrested in conjunction with anti-missile defense rallies at air bases. More than 50 arrests were made at protests at the base from October 2000 through May of this year. A Justice Department report says the number of people behind bars in state prisons fell during the second half of 2000. That was the first decrease since 1972. There were more prisoners in state prisons at the end of the year than at the beginning. And the total number of people in state and federal prisons was up 1.3% over 1999. However, that overall rate of growth was the lowest percentage gain since 1972. Additionally, the absolute increase of prisoners in state and federal prisons combined was the smallest since 1980. Ana Mafo singing Villa-Lobos' Bacchianus, Brazil Yeras, number 5. No words. I'm Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. A Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up in a busy cafe in the northern port city of Haifa yesterday, injuring 15 people and killing himself, just 3 days after a similar attack in Jerusalem, which killed 15 Israelis. The bombing comes as Israeli troops continue to occupy the Orient House and other Palestinian Authority buildings, leading thousands to protest what even U.S. officials call a dangerous escalation of tensions in Israel and the occupied territories. Among the protesters are U.S. and European citizens who've come to the occupied territories to act as human shields in order to protect Palestinians from Israeli troops and settlers. In Hebron, a 7-year-old Palestinian girl also died yesterday of head wounds, which she sustained when she was shot by Israeli soldiers during a gunfight with a group of Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon announced he would allow Foreign Minister Shimon Peres to meet with Palestinians Palestinian leaders to discuss a possible ceasefire, as government spokespeople declare that the Palestinian Authority would no longer be allowed to operate in Jerusalem. We go first to Jerusalem, to Azmi Bashara, a Palestinian Arab and member of the Israeli Knesset. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Can we start Can you start off by talking about the protests that are happening now at Orient House and the significance of the Israeli military's occupation of Orient House, what it is?
Well, the Palestinian protest against the occupation of this building is actually not because of the building itself or because suddenly we realize that there is occupation. Of course, East Jerusalem is occupied since 1967. But this place, the Orient House, and the other eight associations that were closed by Israeli police symbolize the fact that East Jerusalem is a national entity, is a part of the Palestinian national entity, that it has a national existence, that it is represented by the PLO. That's why Mr. Faisal Husseini, who was heading the Orient House until he died 2 months ago, he was a member of the executive committee of the PLO, which meant that the Palestinians in East Jerusalem do not acknowledge the annexation of East Jerusalem by Israel, and they see themselves a part of the Palestinian people. So there is a very, there is a symbolic importance of this place politically. And the fact that Israel closed it actually signified a closure of subject for negotiations. The fact that until 3 days ago, 4 weeks ago, even Likud governments enabled these associations, including the Orient House, to function in Jerusalem, meant that they recognized the fact that the Palestinians in East Jerusalem are Palestinians and they belong to the Palestinian people. And although East Jerusalem is annexed, still the Palestinians were allowed at the time of Rabin, of Prime Minister Rabin, to vote for the Palestinian Legislative Council. The American declaration or the American statement that the Israeli state is a political escalation, somehow it is true. I mean, United States is not so generous in words when it comes to critique against Israel. It is very rare that Israeli states are criticized. But the fact it's called it political escalation, which is a new category. I didn't hear it before from the State Department, this category, political escalation. It is a dangerous political step, an attempt of Israel to use the blood of the victims to achieve political achievements against the Palestinians. But actually what they did is they brought the Palestinian protest into Jerusalem because the Palestinian activists and in general the residents of the city will not just accept the fact that suddenly Sharon decided to close it and to close these associations. Some of them, I want to tell you, do not have only political importance. Some of them are engaged in day-to-day, well served by the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem because they are discriminated as Arabs. And the only address they have to go to and to ask for help in their daily lives, in different issues that have to do with licenses for construction of a house, teaching the son in the university, that has to do with a job or losing a job, having a lawyer to represent them in an Israeli court. The only place to go to are these associations, these organizations that were closed by Israel.
Azmi Bashara, can you?
The protest is very clear.
Can you also talk about your reaction as a member of the Israeli Knesset, as a Palestinian as well, to the latest suicide bomber, this one in Haifa?
Well, this phenomenon of the suicide bombs is a new phenomenon in the Palestinian society. I think in general in the culture of this region, it wasn't so known in the past. It wasn't at all known in the past, actually. And the Palestinian people did go through a long struggle of about a century. And this phenomenon is new. And the first time to be used, it was after the massacre of the prayers in Hebron by a Jewish fundamentalist, Finkelstein, who killed more than 20 people while they were praying in a mosque in Hebron. And after that, the reactions came in that form. It began in Lebanon and then came to our region. Of course, no Palestinian, no rational Palestinian, would think that, first of all, that suicide is good. Nobody believes that, and nobody is glad that or happy that civilians are being killed from both sides. Of course not.
I wanted to.
You have to. You feel sorrow for the fact that people die coincidentally because they were in a bus or in a restaurant. This is not supposed to be a part of any national struggle. But at the end, you make an estimation and you evaluate and you see that these phenomena are produced by the occupation and by the violence, the accumulated violence under the occupied. And that you run out of tools, that these people run out of tools in their struggle. Even the mass demonstrations are costing so many deaths now already. Even the peaceful demonstrations are costing the Palestinian people so many young people who lose their lives in peaceful demonstrations in certain cases. And that the Israeli occupation is becoming so cruel and it's leaving no path to the people, no way, no political options whatsoever. Even Mr. Sharon, he says, when he speaks about achieving a kind of ceasefire, of calm, he does not say what does he suggest politically, what can the Palestinian people expect after a ceasefire politically. He simply does not have a political project at all. So at the end, I have to see, not only as a Palestinian, but even as an analyst, that even the responsibility for the suicide bombs, at the end, it is the responsibility of the situation of occupation. And you can't solve that. You can't solve that when you are producing already young people. The realities are producing young people who are ready to die.
We're
and take as many Israelis with them as they can. If the reality is producing so much rage, so much anger, so much hatred, you have to change the realities. You cannot deal with this situation by looking for people and kill them. They are ready to die anyway. It's not a solution it's not a solution at all to use military tools or violent tools to face such phenomena if they are produced so often already. The only way to deal with these is to have a political solution. And I add to that, a just political solution. Because unjust political solutions were tried. And there is no possibility to derive a political solution only from the balance of power.
We're talking to Azmi Bashara, Palestinian and member of the Israeli Knesset, speaking to us from Jerusalem. In a minute, we're going to go in front of the jail where Palestinians and U.S. citizens are still being held in connection with the demonstrations outside the Orient House in Jerusalem. But first, Phyllis Bennis, fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies here in the United States in Washington and author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. We're going to go to a break in a minute, Phyllis, but as you watch the Israeli flag being raised over Orient House in Jerusalem, what were your thoughts?
I think that, as Azmi Bashara said, this is clearly a message to the Palestinians that the occupation of East Jerusalem, in Israeli mind, is now permanent. These were the words of Uzi Landau, the Minister of Public Security, that this was a, quote, permanent effort to assert Israeli control over all of Jerusalem. But I think that we also have to take into account how this is a message to the international community as a whole. What the Israeli occupation authorities are saying in closing down the Orient House is that it is no longer possible to engage Palestine or to engage Palestinians in diplomacy. The international community has now been excluded, and that the address for international diplomats must go through Israel. I think that's the fundamental international message coming from the Israeli occupation.
Were you surprised at the Secretary of State Colin Powell's words to the Israeli government, talking about this being a political escalation?
It's always a bit of a surprise when there's even a minor criticism of Israel coming from Washington. But in this case, I think we have to recognize that while it may be a politically necessary statement to call it an escalation, there have been no concomitant changes in acts on the ground. The U.S. is continuing to provide diplomatic support for Israel, diplomatic protection in the United Nations, preventing through use of the veto the sending of international observers. The U.S. is continuing to send new helicopter gunships and F-16 fighter jets. So as long as these actions continue on the ground, it's a little hard to take seriously the clear recognition of reality in Colin Powell's statement that this is a political escalation.
Phyllis Bennis, we have to go to break, but when we come back, we'll also be joined, in addition to Azmi Bashara of the Israeli Knesset, Palestinian longtime activist, and Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, we're going to go to outside the prison in Jerusalem, Brian Wood, who is part of a group of people who have gone to be human shields in the occupied territories. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, broadcasting over Pacifica Radio. As we continue with the headline news of the day, the Israeli government seizure of Orient House over the weekend, the Palestinian headquarters in East Jerusalem, Islamic Jihad claiming responsibility for another suicide bombing, this time in Haifa. We're talking to a member of the Israeli Knesset, Palestinian activist Azmi Bashara, as well as Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. And now we go outside a Jerusalem jail to where Brian Wood is standing by. He is a representative, a resident of Colorado, representing the Colorado Campaign for Middle East Peace. He works with the Center for Rapprochement in Bethlehem, a Palestinian Center for Nonviolence, which has been coordinating the arrival of Europeans and U.S. citizens acting as human shields in the territories. Can you tell us what's happening in front of the prison right now and why you're there, Brian? Brian, can you... We'll go to Phyllis Bennis right now. Phyllis, right now, from your perspective, in terms of what we're hearing from the U.S. government, in terms of what's happening on the West Bank, in the occupied territories, where do you see the situation going?
I'm very much afraid, Amy, that we're losing any possibility of a diplomatic solution right now. As long as the U.S. maintains its dominance of the diplomacy and refuses to allow the initiative to come from either the United Nations or even from Europe, from the European Union, we're going to be faced with the problem of the U.S. vantage point shaping the diplomacy. So we have, for example, along with Colin Powell's statement that the seizure of Orient House is what he called political escalation, simultaneously we have the White House spokesman, Andrew Card, speaking only of Palestinian responsibility and raising the possibility that the suicide bombers, who he called terrorists, are creating what Andrew Card called a climate of insecurity in Israel as the major challenge facing U.S. diplomacy. It's a rather astonishing statement given the level of not only insecurity that comes with living under military occupation, but the kind of day-to-day danger faced by Palestinians living in the occupied territories. And to compare that to the psychological sense of insecurity, which no doubt is very real inside Israel, these These suicide bombings, of course, have terrified the population. But it's an example of the kind of one-sidedness in the Israeli approach to the diplomatic process. On a very rare occasion, as Azmi Bashara mentioned earlier, there will be a critical statement coming from the State Department. In general, during the Bush administration, that is immediately answered by a much more explicitly pro-Israeli statement from the White House, undermining the potential of Colin Powell's statement to reflect, to be seen as reflecting actual U.S. policy. And more importantly, there's no motion in the diplomatic arena to change the balance of power. The disparity of power between the two sides is so profound that serious negotiations can only go forward if the weaker side, the Palestinian side, is balanced by an international venue and international credentials. In that context, we can only look at the need for changing changing the nature of diplomacy itself.
I wanted to go to Azmi Bashara for a minute, because I understand that there are or have been indictments that have come down against you, and I wanted to ask, why is this from the Israeli government? You are a Palestinian Knesset member.
Well, yes. Recently, there is an attempt somehow by the Israeli right. I think in the last few years, but in the last couple of years, there is a very intensive process of trying to redraw the limits of Israeli democracy, that it does not contain ideas, or that it does not include ideologies that are outside the Israeli national consent, or outside Zionism, if you want, especially if it comes from the Arab minority side, because there is a feeling in Israel somehow that increasing awareness and consciousness of the Arab minority in Israel may become a threat to the existing order in the country, especially while ideas came out like a state of all citizens, which is considered to be very dangerous for the Israeli democracy, what's supposed to be very very natural for a democracy to become a state of all its citizens. Israel insists on the definition state of the Jews, the majority of whom are not citizens of the state of Israel, of course. And because of the increasing national consciousness of the Arabs in Israel, of their being a national minority, who are natives, who are indigenous people, of course this takes different forms, also a kind of persecution of different political ideas, especially in the case of solidarity with the Palestinian people. Here it is suddenly the question of loyalty is raised. If we express our very natural, very normal solidarity with the Palestinians under occupation, not only because we are Palestinians, but also because we are Israeli citizens, we have a double duty to express our solidarity with people under occupation. In this case, the incitement becomes hysteric because the issue of loyalty is raised, the loyalty to the state.
Azmi Bashara.
We have double loyalty. This time, two speeches were used to incite against me, where I said that resistance against occupation is legitimate. And I think that this statement itself is also legitimate inside any democracy. Not only inside any democracy, also in the international law, resistance against occupation is considered to be legitimate.
Azmi Bashara, I'm going to interrupt because we have Brian Wood on the phone, and he is right outside the jail in Jerusalem right now, where Palestinians and U.S. citizens are still being held in connection with the demonstrations outside the Orient House. Brian Wood, can you tell us what you're doing outside the jail and what is the scene there right now? Brian, can you hear me?
Can you repeat the question?
Brian, I'm just asking you if you can tell us what is the scene outside the jail and who is inside, and speak as loud as you can, even shout.
Okay, right now we have two U.S.
Start again. Can you hear me, Brian?
Can't two Palestinians that were arrested
Saturday,
and they're still being held. As I speak to you now,
how many Palestinians are being held? Did you say?
In total, there are about a half a dozen right now. Two of them right now are in the court with one of the U.S. citizens, and they're all being taken together because they have the same charges.
And you were talking about the Americans. Go on.
Yes. The two American citizens, one of them, the hearing for her case will be delayed. They'll meet again with a judge tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, the Israeli police are trying to force her to sign documents saying she won't protest near the Orient House anymore. She's refusing that on principle, and she's also standing in solidarity with the Palestinian prisoners as their situation inside the prison will always be much worse than internationals. So she is standing with them in solidarity and will not leave the prison until they are released. However, this is the Palestinians may be released this afternoon. As I said, they're in the court right now with the judge trying to work out the details.
Can you talk about the protests outside Orient House? We had hoped to have Hanan Ashrawi on. She is feeling sick right now. She was outside Orient House. I understand she also got hurt there.
I wasn't there today at the demonstration because I've been here at the Russian compound all day trying to get supplies into those that were in prison, like towels and soap and shampoo, which the police have continued to refuse to accept these items in for the prisoners. By this time, they accept them there. By this time, three of them, we don't know if they've accepted the supplies we brought for them, and one of them, they accepted the supplies. They also won't allow any of us to visit them simply because they were arrested at the Orient House. This is what we were told when we came this morning.
Can you talk about the...
So I've been here at the compound all day tracking the situation with those who were arrested on Saturday.
Can you talk about the whole Human Shield program that you're a part of, why you went to the occupied territories?
Yes. The system here, unfortunately to say, in Israel is very, very racist, and to the degree that Israeli police, Israeli military do not have concern for Palestinian lives. In a situation like that, they have no difficulty beating them, killing them, bombing their cities, etc. It takes international people who they must be careful about how they treat them, for nothing more than diplomatic relations with those countries. It's unfortunate that we're in such a situation as this, but it requires International Protection Force, which the Palestinians have called for consistently and was vetoed by the U.S. in a U.S. security resolution back in January. We continue as internationals living in the occupied territories to call on internationals from North America, from Europe, and anywhere else in the world to come and to join this movement of international protection for the Palestinians. It may not happen on a diplomatic level, but and because of that situation, we need to create it from a grassroots standpoint. So this is our attempt right now to do exactly this, to create a human shield for the Palestinian people in whatever way we can.
Now,
the numbers are small at this point, only a couple dozen, so the actual protection we can provide for the Palestinian people is in some ways symbolic rather than practical. However, standing with the people in solidarity with them, we've been told numerous times by these people that it does an enormous amount for them, that they know that they are not forgotten, and they know that people from outside of their country are concerned about their situation.
Brian Wood, you're quite young. You just graduated from college, majoring in Bible studies, but you started off by going to a Jewish settlement. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I was here in the summer of 98. I lived in a settlement on the West Bank for 5 weeks. From that vantage point, I had a clear opportunity to experience the life on the Israeli side and the life on the Palestinian side. And it's horrifying to me that I lived in a practical mansion in the West Bank that's built on land that's confiscated from Palestinians, that had a swimming pool, that had green grass, when just across the valley there is a Palestinian village that probably at this time in the summer doesn't have drinking water or water to take showers with. It's quite a horrifying and segregated scene here that's built on a system of imposed segregation and racism that requires, as I said, international protection force for the Palestinian people in this situation.
You just came from Bethlehem. What is the scene like there now in the midst of the escalation?
Yes, I've been staying in Beit Jala for the last 3 weeks. We've been so focused our efforts for a human shield in Beit Jala because of what has taken place there in the last 10 months. It's a small town of 12,000 Palestinians. Out of this town, there's been close to 800 homes that have been damaged or destroyed. There's been six people in the village killed and about 150 injuries. For this reason, we have chosen Beit Jala because of the way it's been hit incredibly hard by the Israeli military that's stationed in the nearby settlement of Gilo. And people claim that it's a gun battle that goes back and forth between Beit Jala and between Gilo. But the realities are Gilo is a Jewish-only settlement that's built on land that was 30 years ago the other half of Beit Jala. The family I stay with in Beit Jala still owns land in what is now Gilo. And the material and human losses between Beit Jala and Gilo signify that this is not a gun battle between some equal militaries, and it depicts that the force of the Israeli military is very strong. They are the fourth largest military in the world, and the Palestinians have no military. There's been only a handful of injuries in Gilo. There's been some damages to the apartments in Gilo, but compared to what's taken place in Beit Jala, we can understand very clearly that there's no equality in the amount of offense or defensive positions the two sides can take.
Well, Brian Wood, I want
to... For this reason, as I said, this is why we've targeted Beit Jala as for the Human Shield Project.
I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to follow the work of the Human Shields in the occupied territories, where can they go on the web?
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
Where can people get information on the web about your Human Shield project?
As of now, we don't have any information up on the website. They can certainly, I'd be glad to pass along my phone number to you, and people can contact me by telephone if they would like to come.
And, Brian, we will put that... We will put that information on the web, your phone number. People can go to webactive.com. Also hear the program again as well as it's in the archives there. Brian Wood, representing the Colorado Campaign for Middle East Peace. He's standing outside the jail in Jerusalem where Palestinians and U.S. citizens are still being held after protesting outside the Orient House in Jerusalem, which has been occupied by the Israeli military. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to find out about an expose of how The sanctions that the U.S. has used against Iraq were intentionally used to destroy Iraq's water supply. It's a new piece in the Progressive magazine, researcher who got documents from the U.S. government. Stay with us. That musical interlude, Phil Upchurch, Tell the Truth, here on Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The Russian government this weekend condemned the U.S. and Britain for airstrikes against three targets on Friday, which killed one Iraqi and injured 11. The Russian announcement came on the eve of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's arrival in Moscow to plead his case for Star Wars. Friday's airstrikes are the latest example of the near total isolation of the U.S. on the issue of sanctions against Iraq. The U.S. and Britain are virtually alone in their insistence that economic sanctions against Iraq and U.N. control over Iraq's revenue must continue. The U.S. has held up hundreds of contracts approved under the U.N.'s so-called Oil for Food program, which allows Iraq to use a percentage of its oil revenues to purchase food, medicines, and spare parts. Among the most desperately needed supplies are chlorine and spare parts to repair Iraq's devastated sewage and water treatment infrastructure, which were destroyed by the U.S. bombing during the Persian Gulf War. Waterborne diseases continue to kill thousands of children and elderly people already suffering from malnutrition after more than a decade of sanctions, which have resulted in the deaths of more than a million Iraqi civilians. Outside the United Nations, as we speak, a group of people from Voices in the Wilderness are on a 40-day hunger fast to protest the sanctions. Well, now newly declassified documents show that U.S. officials were perfectly aware of the impact that U.S. bombing and sanctions would have on Iraq's water supply, even predicting that epidemics of death and disease would result if Iraq did not have access to chlorine and spare parts to treat its water. We're joined right now by Tom Nagy, who is author of The Secret Behind the Sanctions, How the U.S. Intentionally Destroyed Iraq's Water Supply, just published cover story in the September issue of the Progressive magazine. He's an associate professor of expert systems at George Washington University. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's a great honor to be on the most important radio program in the United States today.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. Tell us about the documents that you've gotten a hold of and what they mean.
Well, the documents, which I thought at first were a fraud, are from the Department of Defense's GulfLink website. I think it's important to realize that these are all formerly classified documents never intended to be seen by the American public. They were declassified between 1995 and 1997. The documents that I cite in the article are all from 1991, and they are so incredible that I would really urge your listeners to go to the Department of Defense's GulfLink website and see for themselves. In fact, I gave two papers at Department of Defense conferences on this, really hoping that somebody would stand up and say, no, you've got it, you've been hoaxed, you've got it wrong. Went through quite a lot to establish the authenticity of the documents. Never happened. People were unhappy, but never any indication that these things are fakes. Also gave a paper in June at the Association of Genocide Scholars, hoping that someone would say, well, there's a whole series of terrible flaws in your reasoning. I really don't want to believe that the United States has actually done this.
Tom Nagy, explain exactly what the documents say.
The fundamental document is Iraq water treatment vulnerabilities, done just as the war was formally started in 1991. And what it does is it lays out in great detail the fact that Iraq has no way, absolutely no way, in fact, analyzes all the possible countermeasures, that it can produce pure water for its population and can keep vital industries like food processing and pharmaceuticals going unless they can get an exemption from UN sanctions to import a small set of chemicals and items of equipment. Without that, they are just doomed. And it says that in 6 months, the water supply system will be, the water treatment system will be fully degraded. This document, at least, and part of it is still classified, doesn't even talk about the destruction of the electrical system on which the water supply and the treatment facilities depended. This is just from the use of the sanctions. Then, as we were soothingly told that all, if there were any increases in the loss of lives of the very young and the very old, it was entirely the fault of the government of Iraq, it turns out that there were a whole series of other documents that I've uncovered rather laboriously, also in 1991, in January, in February, in March, June, November, which shows a common theme. They knew that there were epidemics of waterborne diseases. They knew that it was killing mostly the kids. They knew that the cause of these diseases were the fact that Iraq could not generate drinkable water. And finally, they had damage control sorts of things that, for example, as late as last year, what is his name, Jeremy, I can't remember his last name, the State Department guy, in his interview with John Pilger, he says, oh, well, a lot of Iraqi kids have died. Oh, well, you know, Iraq has always had terrible health conditions, which is an absolute lie. It had
Jamie Rubin was?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Jamie. And by the way, I'd like to urge that everybody read or everyone get a hold of this marvelous videotape of John Pilger on the sanctions and their effects.
Yeah, we actually played excerpts of it last year, and people can go back in the Web Active archives and hear parts of that documentary on Democracy Now!
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, Tom Nagy, would you call these sanctions, given the way they're even described in the U.S. documents in terms of destroying the water supply of Iraq, biological warfare? And how much did U.S. officials know about this?
Oh, they knew in tremendous detail. And then, you know, it's kind of funny. When you say biological warfare, what I think of and I think everybody thinks of is, oh, you're having a glass of water and I distract you and I pour some pathogen into your glass of water. Well, you know, that may be one way of doing it. But another way is simply to make sure that the city that you live in, there's pathogens in the water supply. And if I can somehow block the effective use of that, the capacity of New York City, if that's where you live, from producing clean water, you're equally dead. It's just, and I have the benefit, I guess it's much more efficient if I'm interested in very large-scale terror against the people of New York. So the United States understands that terrorism, bioterrorism, isn't simply a matter of dumping pathogens into a glass of water or into a pool of water. The reason that it's very clear if you read open source literature from the United States military, they're very worried about biowarfare, and part of biowarfare would be some terrorist other than the U.S. government going into the code that controls the computer programs that control the water purification systems and incapacitating these water purification systems. So the U.S. understands that there's more than one way of doing bioterrorism. So I think it's very, very clear. And then if I could just follow by citing the Geneva Convention, the 79 additional protocol, Article 54, it makes it so abundantly clear that it is absolutely prohibited to attack or to render useless objects indispensable to the survival of human populations, such as drinking water installations and supplies in irrigation works, for the purposes of denying them for their subsistence value to the civilian population or the adverse party, whatever the motive. Representative McKinney, Democrat of Georgia, giving testimony in the Operations and Human Rights Subcommittee of Congress just a couple of months ago, said attacking Iraqi public water drinking flagrantly targets civilians and is a violation of the Geneva Convention and of the fundamental laws of civilized nations.
Tom Nagy, if people want to get a hold of your piece that's in the Progressive, where can they go on the web? The piece is really called The Secret.
It's just www.progressive.org.
That's progressive.org. Thomas Nagy, author of The Secret Behind the Sanctions, How the U.S. Intentionally Destroyed Iraq's Water Supply. I want to thank you very much for being with us. As we quickly move on to our last segment, you know that last week President Bush made the decision to prohibit federal funding for most forms of stem cell research, although he has allowed it in limited cases of existing lines of stem cells. Well, today we turn to Professor Emerita of Biology at Harvard University, Ruth Hubbard, who is one of the founding board members of the Council for Responsible Genetics, who says that the most immediate problem with Bush's stance is that by saying there will be no federal funding for initial stem cell research, that means there will be no federal regulation. We're going to talk about what limited federal funding means when it comes to regulations. I reached her last night at her home in the Cape, and this is what Ruth Hubbard had to say.
Well, there's a problem. There are several problems with President Bush's decision about stem cell research. The most important thing, to my way of thinking, is that by limiting the funding to only the cell lines that have already been cultured and developed, he is making it difficult, if not impossible, to monitor and control the research that is going to be going on with cell lines that will be developed henceforth. So I would have preferred, if he was going to go ahead with federal funding for this research, if he had been willing to fund all the research that's done on embryos that are byproducts of fertility treatments. I think it's important to not just not fund, but to, in fact, say that there should not or cannot or must not be any research done on embryos that are produced specifically for research purposes, and that no one, no women should be being paid to produce eggs in order to produce embryos in this totally impersonal and commercial way.
You know, this is interesting because with the media reports of the first reaction to President Bush's announcement, it made it sound like his was the most rigid regulation, and what Democrats and critics wanted was basically was less regulation. But you're pointing out something else, that what he has done has meant that there is less regulation. Can you explain that?
Right. I mean, the fact is that unfortunately, the way our system works in this country, the only way for the only access the federal government has to this research is by funding it. If if we leave it to the private sector, then unless one could get Congress to pass a law forbidding the production of embryos for research, this is going to continue. I mean, I was very shocked when I heard that two private companies, organizations, have already admitted doing this. We don't know that they're the only ones. They're the only ones who said they're doing it.
Doing what?
Who have said that they are paying women and men to produce eggs and sperm, which they then, which the firms then put together, mix in order to make embryos for research.
And that's not illegal under President Bush has proposed.
Oh, no. He said he isn't going to fund it, but that doesn't say it's illegal.
And was it different under President Clinton?
No, I'm afraid it wasn't, because at this point, as I understand it, the government has authority only over research that it funds.
What about in other countries? How does it work?
In other countries, there are laws. Britain has a law. Germany has a law. And they have laws that regulate this, irrespective of whether it's done under government auspices or whether it's done in the private sector. And that's what we really need, because as long as it can be done in the private sector, it really doesn't matter all that much what regulation the government puts, what regulation the National Institutes of Health put on. And I think that's extremely worrisome. See, there are very, very clear laws about, for example, in Britain, there is a very clear law that says that a woman's egg can only be collected in order to fertilize it and then implant it back in that same woman. And she cannot be paid for any of this. That immediately takes care of this situation. Similarly in Germany.
What companies here have...
I want to thank you very much for being with us. That was
Ruth Hubbard. Ruth Hubbard is a professor emerita of biology at Harvard University, and that does it for our program as she responds to President Bush's decision to, in a very limited way, fund stem cell research. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Acknowledging those who make Democracy Now! Possible, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports public radio, Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, Pacifica affiliates, and of course, all of that means all of you. We are Pacifica Radio. From the embattled sub-studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!